This episode is sponsored by Verisk Marketing Solutions. The future of consumer experience requires a deeper data-driven understanding of identity, behavior, and privacy. Join marketing leaders and industry execs at the VIA 2023 Consumer Insights and Experience Summit, September 18th and 19th in Chicago's Fulton Market District. They'll explain how they can future-proof their businesses and do right by their customers with you. Spots are limited. Register now at marketing.verisk.com/via. Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers weekly listen, an e-marketer podcast made possible by Verisk Marketing Solutions. This is the Friday show that still buys their movie tickets in person. Some of us do, don't we, Susie?
Yes.
Do you still buy your airline tickets from the airline desk at the airport?
Doesn't everybody?
Good God, we must move on. Oh, my goodness. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson, who doesn't buy his tickets that way, like everyone else. In today's show, Twitter becomes X.
If I'm an advertiser, I'm still in the sort of wait and see moment to just see, you know, where Twitter or whatever it becomes is when Elon, you know, is done sort of shaking the box up.
Is Walmart trouncing Amazon in the grocery wars?
Some people want to visit a grocery store for interaction. Other people want to just pick out the freshest ingredients, or they like to browse the aisles for inspiration. Some people don't want to pay a delivery fee. But whatever the reason, it means that Amazon is just at such a huge disadvantage without the sort of store network that its rivals have.
A billboard for your living room?
I can't imagine that you would want to have a running sort of billboard style mechanism in your house that has a camera sensory that can watch what you're doing. It just doesn't make sense for me.
Are Gen Zers upending the purchase funnel? Why don't Airbnb have a loyalty program? And we'll talk about the most popular museums in the world. Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start by meeting someone who's first weekly listen. This is, she is one of our senior analysts covering everything UK and Western Europe with an emphasis on retail, based on the south coast of England. It's Karina Perkins.
Hi, Marcus. Very excited to be on.
Hello. Your tone suggests otherwise. What? Thanks, Marcus. Happy to be here. We made her be here. We're also joined by Blake Droche, who is one of our senior analysts on the retail and e-commerce team based out of New York. Hey, fella.
Good to be here, Marcus.
Better.
Genuinely.
And finally, we're joined by one of our vice presidents of content, heads up the retail and e-commerce desk based out of New York as well. It's Susie David-Canyon.
Hi, everyone.
There we go.
That's I win. I'm totally winning this week.
You don't win.
I it did. Doesn't mean you win. I just won.
Okay. Which means did. Past tense. That's what we're doing?
Yeah.
Okay. What do we have in store for you this week? Well, we have a story of the week, of course. We'll talk about Twitter becoming X. What does that mean? Then we move to the game of the week. Susie will probably lose. It's called What's the Point? And our panel, Susie, Karina, and Blake, will give us the best takeaways they can from each of the four stories we have for you. And then we move to dinner party data. We'll just chat about some random stuff we just recently learned. But we start, of course, with the story of the week. Twitter becomes X. Sarah Morrison of Vox writes, "Welcome to X, the wannabe super app, formerly known as Twitter. What's happening? Well, Elon Musk just rolled out a new X logo on Twitter. He owns Twitter, now X, kind of. It replaces the signature blue bird called Larry, after Larry Bird. Very clever. Mr. Musk, who bought Twitter last year, has long described his vision of an everything app. That new Twitter or X CEO Linda Yaccarino describes as including audio, video, messaging, and banking capabilities. Folks, we'll start here. What do we make of this move from Twitter to kind of become X, but it's still called Twitter?
Well, I don't think that the name change is really going to do anything to make a difference to the Twitter platform. I think, you know, the small but active user base is going to remain small but active no matter what the site is called, just as long as the core functions of the user experience sort of remain intact or as they are right now.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I also don't think it's going to do anything to help Twitter's prospects as a business. The advertising is still plummeting and the other monetization efforts don't really seem to be catching on. But I guess what it does, you know, say to me is that Elon Musk's, you know, idea here isn't really making Twitter financially viable as a standalone app. I think he just has his sights on creating the super app. And if he could turn something like payments or banking or some other aspect of it into the profit center, then in theory, it could subsidize the feature like Twitter. But that's a pretty big if, right? Because he still needs to build this giant new app.
Yeah. It seems like it came out of nowhere, but it didn't at all. There's plenty of tea leaves if you were reading them. So a couple here. 1999, Mr. Musk developed a concept for a one-stop everything store to handle anything and everything financial, banking, credit cards, digital purchases, investments, loans. This former online banking startup, X.com, later became PayPal. Now if you go to X.com, it's Twitter. But he started PayPal, which was X.com. Also, it's in the name of his space exploration company that he started in 2002, SpaceX. It's the name of his car company, Tesla's SUV, the Model X. It's in the name of his new AI startup, X.AI. One of his kids' names starts with an X, and then it's a bunch of letters and numbers. He explicitly said he wants to turn Twitter into X, the everything app. And back in October, he said buying Twitter was an accelerant to creating X, the everything app. And Twitter said in April that they legally filed that the company had a new name called X Corp. So maybe it should be less surprising than it seems.
What I find really fascinating here, and maybe it's a lesson about rebranding do's and don'ts, is that if they've had so much time to prepare and this has been in his mind for such a long time, I find it really strange that they've changed the logo on site, but it still says Twitter all over it. It's still got a big blue button saying tweet. I really find it, that's what I find really bizarre. It's like a kind of half job of a rebrand and it seems really rushed. And I'm interested to know why that has been so rushed. And also, there's all of these issues with other companies owning trademarks relating to certain goods and services for X. So it's something that's been brewing for a long time, but it doesn't feel like a particularly well thought out strategy at the same time.
Well, I feel like, to your point, it seems like a lot of starts and stops. And yes, the starts and stops date back for a long time, but nothing seems to be moving in the same direction. And so he's literally building a company or a new vision on the go, or as they say, you know, flying the airplane before it's built. What I find even more fascinating is, never mind that he's wiping out all of that brand love and all of the value of the Twitter brand, which is in the billions and billions of dollars, is that it's an interim X. The logo that they put up isn't even the real logo yet.
Right.
There's a chance they're going to change that logo. Like, how many times are businesses who have the like little logos at the bottom of the different, you know, ways you can contact them are going to change that logo out? I mean, it's just absurd. The back and forth, the like seemingly unorganized way of doing something is just mind-blowing. And I wonder if Linda knew about all, I'm calling her Linda. I wonder if she knew. She's my friend, you know. I wonder if she knew. I'm going to have to ask her. Did she know that all this was coming when she got hired? Because like, that does not bode well, as Karina said, for marketers, you know, toolkit.
Apparently the police got called because they were removing the letter, the Twitter from the HQ. And there was a big confusion because they hadn't notified authorities that they were going to be doing that. So the police got called, and it just ended up with ER and the logo on the building, which, again, I think just points to this. It's something which has perhaps been brewing in his mind for a long time, but I'm not sure how long it's been a kind of carefully thought out strategy for the company.
Yeah.
Just seems so irrational in some ways, right?
It definitely feels like one or the other. Like, he sat down to play checkers and he's actually playing like either Uno or 3D chess. Like, he's playing one of the two extremes. Either none of it's thought out and it's kind of cobbled together on the fly, or he has this vision and he's always had this vision. And buying Twitter, getting rid of a lot of the staff and changing some of the roles at the company they want to focus on, focusing less on advertisers and advertising, knowing that in the future, we're going to rely less on advertising. He was saying recently that Twitter ad revenue is down 50%. Maybe that's because they know they're going to rely less on advertising because they're trying to turn Twitter, which is now kind of X, into this super app. And so it brings me to the next question. So WeChat in China, it's kind of the gold standard of super apps, acts like basically opening a browser on your computer. It's the thing you do before you do anything else. Message people, read the news, buy things, pay rent, book doctor's appointments. So you do everything in this WeChat app in China. He wants to create a similar type of app in the US. Is a super app even possible?
So I think before I answer that question, because I do have thoughts on that, I think one of the things that CEOs, owners sometimes forget is you might want to do something, but if you don't have the customer base, like if you think about JCPenney and Ron Johnson, you might want to create a town square in the middle of JCPenney and get rid of the coupons and just do everyday low pricing. But if your current consumer is not with you on that track, and if you're not going to court a new consumer, then it doesn't matter. So for the super app, can we have one? Is Twitter the base? I'm not sure that that is true. Can this idea of Twitter as what was once thought of as the town square be sort of thought more broadly as a super app? Kind of, because if you think about it like a town square, there's the market that's there that comes once a week. People go there and hang out and chat. People, you know, exchange ideas. So I do think you can build community and so then a super app around a town square concept. I just think that the way he's going about it seems so, I don't know if the right word is delusional. I don't know what the right word to use is, like irrational, just like unthought out. But to your point, Marcus, maybe it's all part of a plan and he's trying to get everybody down to surprise them with a big win.
Yeah.
I mean, I wonder as well, you know, just because you can do something, and I have no doubt that he could build something like that, but do people actually want it? I mean, I don't know about the rest of you, but I don't wake up every day thinking, oh, I wish there was one app that I could open that I could do everything in. And, you know, China and the internet and e-commerce have developed in a very different way than we have developed in the West. And you can see that in social commerce. And, you know, everyone is desperate for live streaming to be a success in the US and in Europe. But is it a success? Not so much, because consumers aren't sort of desperately wanting that. So build it and they will come is not necessarily true in this case, I think, unless it's genuinely answering a problem that people have.
Right. People in the West have. A lot of the examples they're all outside the US. China's WeChat, India's Paytm, Indonesia's Gojek.
Exactly. And I think Uber will probably be a more successful sort of super app. It's halfway there than would Twitter turned X.
Well, so this was one of my points, is that do you need to be a super app to succeed in the West? Because we've gone from app to super app without thinking there's anything in between. And maybe just a multi-purpose app is enough. For Uber, to your point, Susie, does ride hailing and food delivery and grocery delivery and things like that. On Facebook, you can message people and buy and sell things and watch videos. And so maybe an app that does three or four or five things is good enough. It doesn't have to be WeChat, which does 30 plus things.
Exactly. We'll see. You can see the benefit to the super app of having everyone do it on their platform, but what's the benefit to the user?
Yeah. Yeah. So Jason Goldman, former head of product at Twitter, says it doesn't make a lot of sense to replace a globally recognized brand with a generic placeholder symbol. We talked about Twitter admitting that ad revenue is down 50%. Quick thought here, folks. I mean, how are advertisers going to feel in this moment and over the coming weeks, month, two?
I don't think it's going to really make any difference. I mean, it's not like, you know, the name is different, but the reputation's the same. The reputation comes with it. The ad tools come with it. The audience comes with it. If I'm an advertiser, I'm still in the sort of wait and see moment to just see, you know, where Twitter or whatever it becomes is when Elon, you know, is done sort of shaking the box up. And it's clear that he's definitely not done yet. So I think it's still just very much, you know, wait and see, but there are plenty of other places to spend your money.
I don't think the kind of rebrand in itself is necessarily going to put advertisers off, but potentially the chaos around it might.
Yeah, I was going to say it certainly adds to the uncertainty, to the tornado that's been swirling around this company since he bought it last year. And trust issues is one thing. Syracuse University professor Jennifer Greigel, she was telling NPR, I'm not sure Mr. Musk has enough trust from his user base to get people to actually exchange money or attach any type of financial institution to this app, adding that Mr. Musk hurt Twitter's integrity with decisions like removing blue checks, firing thousands of Twitter staff, and reinstating problematic accounts. So trust issues for advertisers, also for users. On the other hand, journalism professor at the University of Cincinnati, Jeffrey Blebbins, thinks that Mr. Musk has dismayed a significant portion of Twitter users, so much so that a rebranding can't hurt, saying that this could be a way maybe to try to save it essentially by destroying it and recreating it as something else. This could be seen as to help it in terms of a counter PR move to the Threads launch, reinvigorating the Twitter brand, the Wall Street Journal was suggesting. But one thing I think is important to note, the regulatory hurdles, trying to build a super app in the US could be very tricky. That's what we've got time for the story of the week. We'll keep an eye on this, of course. Time now for the game of the week. Today's game, What's the Point? Where I read out four stories and have contestants Susie, Karina, and Blake tell us what they think is the main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point, good answers get 2, and answers that leave you with the same feeling as actually thinking of a perfect comeback in the moment and not 2 weeks later, aka how Susie feels after most shows. So answers that leave you with that feeling, they get you 3 points.
Nobody thought that was a good one.
Yeah. Fair. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. If you run long, so Karina, what's your favourite sport? Let's use an analogy from your favourite sport.
Oh, good luck with that. Eventing. Oh,
he doesn't. One more time.
Eventing.
Eventing.
Eventing, yeah. It's a 3-stage horse sport.
Okay, pick again. are there penalties in that?
There are penalties in that, yeah.
What penalties
do you get? It's all about penalties. So when you're doing your dressage, which is the first stage, you get penalties for any mistakes that you make or incorrect movements. When you do the show jumping, you get penalties for any fences that are knocked down or refused. And on the cross country, similarly, you get penalties for hitting fences and or falling off.
Okay, so we'll go with football. So football or soccer.
Wait, falls off the horse?
Oh, sometimes, yeah.
Wow. And they're not disqualified? It's just penalties?
No, they are now disqualified, okay. Actually. Yeah, they fall off, yeah.
Oh.
They shouldn't be in that tournament.
Insult to injury. After you've fallen off, you're also disqualified.
I mean,
you're in blinding pain and you're also out of the competition. Yeah. Goodbye. We're going to use football. Thank you so much for suggesting. Karina, if you could just say football, we can cut that in and then cut everything else you've said. That'd be really helpful. Karina, your favourite sport?
Football. But when I talk about football, I'm talking about soccer because I'm in the UK.
Hello. I see what she's done. She speaks American. So yeah, football, soccer, if you run long, then you get a yellow card and minus 2 points. Two yellows gets you a red and a sending off. Whoever has the most points wins, gets the last word. Let's play. We start with round one, of course. Karina's going to go first for us. Is Walmart trouncing Amazon in the grocery wars? A recent Economist article suggests that Walmart is more of a threat to the e-commerce giant than the other way around. Threat to Amazon than the other way around. The piece suggests that since its $14 billion acquisition of Whole Foods in 2017, Amazon has treated grocery more like a science experiment and notes that Walmart's lead is huge, saying that it has the largest footprint in America, close to 5,000 outlets versus around 500 for Whole Foods, 44 Amazon Fresh stores and 22 Amazon Go shops. But Karina, is Walmart trouncing Amazon in the grocery wars? What's the point?
So my take on this is actually, it's not just about Amazon and Walmart. It's also about Amazon and the big grocers in the UK. And it's all around the complexity of grocery. So that's partly because of the various logistical challenges around selling fresh food and instead of goods. But it's also to do with the fact that people have quite an emotional relationship with food and drink, and they tend to have quite strong loyalties with their grocery chains. So it's possible to convince people to change their supermarket, and we've seen that with the success of the discount chains in the UK, but it's not really that easy. And I think that Amazon is going about it all wrong. So if you look at the ideas they discuss at the beginning of the article, there was an ice cream truck for adults selling porterhouse steaks or a single cow burger. It's really wide of the mark when it comes to fulfilling what people need or want from grocery retailers. And to an extent, the same applies to Amazon's Just Walk Out stores, which are all about convenience when actually people are really worried at the moment about price. And what people really want from grocery is decent food that they can trust at a price that they can afford week in, week out. And it's what the established grocery chains are really good at delivering, but it's really difficult to achieve while turning a profit, especially without long-established supplier networks, expertise and experience that the big grocery players have. And crucially for Amazon, food is the one thing that people really like to buy in person. So some people want to visit a grocery store for interaction. Other people want to just pick out the freshest ingredients, or they like to browse the aisles for inspiration. Some people don't want to pay a delivery fee. But whatever the reason, it means that Amazon is just at such a huge disadvantage without the sort of store network that its rivals have. On the flip side, its rivals moving more into general merchandise and copying Amazon's third-party model is a relatively simple step. So again, I think it's at a disadvantage there, especially as we're going to see more people spending more on food and drink and less on non-essentials. So that's my take.
It wasn't close to 20 seconds. but it was an excellent answer.
I was wondering if she was going to be like the rider who fell off the horse and just got disqualified.
I thought I was going to get buzzed when I was at time.
No.
This is self-measured.
Yeah. Why not?
That was kind of awesome. I love it. It's her first time. I think we leave it.
Yeah.
We do leave it. We give her a warning, but it was an excellent answer. Blake, anything to add? Probably
that,
not.
That was a great answer, but I felt like I was watching a football match because I wasn't sure when it was going to end. I'll give the, even though this was an article in The Economist, it's a good take. I'll give the U.S. side of it is that I think it will be far easier for Walmart, I agree, to expand and grow in e-commerce than it will for Amazon, which, you know, doesn't have a physical grocery presence to really catch up in grocery. I think from a forecast perspective, I see that Walmart could actually take much larger gains in the U.S. digital grocery market over Amazon in the coming years, especially as click and collect starts to fuel more and more of the digital grocery growth. But the catch is that that's only grocery. Amazon has about 37% of U.S. e-commerce market share, while Walmart has about 6%. And that's a huge difference. And I don't really see that budging significantly in any direction in the near future.
Yeah. Susie?
I'm just going to only add that it's funny that it's the war is heating up. I think we wouldn't be saying that if it wasn't post-COVID. I think before COVID, there was no war. It was very clear that Amazon was winning. I think it's interesting to compare them because they have different customer profiles, they have different merchandise mix, and they have a different channel mix. So comparing the entirety the way we have been just doesn't make sense. Comparing business by business, like Blake and Karina have said, Amazon is definitely losing when it comes to grocery. And the idea that people don't want to interact with folks when they go to the store and just do the just walk out technology seems absurd.
Mm. Yeah. Big part of why you go to stores or leave the house. Yeah. 2 points for me. One, Walmart rules brick and mortar, or rules the brick and mortar world. And grocery is brick and mortar. Just 10% of America's $800 billion food shopping business is done online. The article was noting that means 90% is done in brick and mortar land. The second point is physical store sales are a tiny piece of Amazon's business. They only account for about 4% of its earnings, so just not a priority at the moment. We move to round two. We start with Blake. A billboard for the living room. Megan Graham of the Wall Street Journal explains that a startup called Telly has begun sending free smart TVs to US homes. The catch, it comes with an attached lower screen to display targeted ads, news, scores, etc. when the TV is on and even when it's off. If people so choose, Telly is offering programmatic advertising with plans to introduce its own self-serve platform as well. Around 250,000 people in the US have signed up to get Telly sets in the first week that they were offered in May. Telly plans to ship 500,000, half a million by the year's end. But Blake, a billboard for the living room, what's the point?
I think the feature itself really isn't all that terrible, at least from a personal perspective. Like if I'm working from home and I have the news on in the background, then I wouldn't actually mind seeing like a stock ticker or like sports scores flash across the bottom of the screen. But if the value proposition for Telly is reaching the non-TV audience, so the younger audience, I wonder if that type of behavior is really common enough to make it work. I think like having the TV on in the background all day is kind of an older person's habit, and younger people don't really use their televisions that way. I also think it's weird that the TV has a sensor in it that detects whether people are present and in what quantity, the article says. I think that's really going to freak people out. And I think it's also going to disappoint advertisers, because if the point of this, like I said, is like having that TV on in the background, they're going to realize how much of their ad spending on TV is just wasted on an empty TV screen that no one's watching.
Susie.
So the article did say you can have the bottom on without the TV being on. It's just a different setting. The truth is that I'm never going to be an entrepreneur because I think this is a horrible idea. I can't imagine that you would want to have a running sort of billboard style mechanism in your house that has a camera. like Blake was saying, a sensory that can watch what you're doing. It just doesn't make sense for me. I think gone are the days where TVs were so expensive that people didn't want to buy them. Like, I can't even imagine how they got those 200,000 people. They did say that the average household income was 50,000 and more. And so even that is like, that's maybe not everybody's target market, that household income, right? I think it's all very confusing.
Okay, Karina, you're up.
Okay.
I have to stress. Brevity.
Brevity. Go. So I actually love this, and I think it's a really great example of the value exchange when it comes to data privacy. So I think what I really like about it is that, you know, we're being tracked by brands and companies every time we use our smartphone. And I just love the fact that they're being really upfront about it. It's like, we are going to track you. We are going to take this data from you. We're going to put a camera on it, but you get a free TV. So people have the choice then, don't they? And I think actually a lot of Gen Z in particular, they're quite comfortable with sharing their data as long as that people are kind of truthful about how it's going to be used and they're really upfront about that value exchange. So I think actually it's quite a good idea.
Nice, folks. Well, the halfway mark, let's count the scores. Everyone's on 5. Karina had 3 points in the first round to Blake and Susie's 2 apiece. And then Blake and Susie had slightly better answers in the second round. So they get the 3 points. But we're tied up on 5 heading into round 3. We start with Susie for round 3. Are Gen Z upending the purchase funnel? A recent Edelman Trust Barometer report thinks so. Julia Hood of our sister company Business Insider writes that the purchase is often the starting point for the brand relationship, not the final step, running counter to the traditional purchase funnel model. The Edelman report notes that Gen Z's true relationship with brands often begins at purchase and is too dynamic for a linear funnel. Susie, Gen Z is upending the purchase funnel. What's the point?
So I think the title is a little bit off in the article. What I do think, though, which is an interesting concept, is we talk a lot about how the path to purchase is no longer linear, that now it's much more, you know, lots of different ups and downs before you make a final decision, lots of different touch points before you get there. I like the idea of it being a loop, in that sometimes brands forget that once the purchase has been made and you've converted them, to keep them engaged with your brand. I think the way they talk about the relationship post-purchase is a little bit inaccurate, because you will never get someone to buy from you unless they feel strongly about you. Of course, if you're bread or some sort of, even that is no longer basic, right? If you're some basic item, then the relationship doesn't matter, but nothing is basic anymore. So I just think that phrased inaccurately, but the idea of the loop is very interesting and one that everybody should be aware of.
Karina.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not convinced that purchase is the end point for any consumer anymore, regardless of age, to be honest. And I think the funnel collapsed in on itself a little while ago, and that consumers' relationships with brands have been dynamic for quite a long time. For me, the really interesting point here was the kind of expectations that Gen Z have around ethical and social issues. And they were more likely to say than any other age group that they want companies to make their values clear. And I think that's a really difficult point for brands, because we've seen some brands trying to market on social issues or environmental issues and then run in trouble with that. So I think that's a real kind of conundrum. And I think it really comes down to just being truthful, because if a brand has a value that they're willing to stand by, then that is something that will attract Gen Z. And also, if they do get a backlash, they can kind of truthfully stand by it.
Blake.
Yeah, I agree. I think this, you know, the article does definitely take some liberties in assuming that Gen Z doesn't also find things that attract them or make them loyal to the brand before they make the purchase. And it also doesn't show comparisons to other generations to detail, you know, how different they are. I think what it does get right is that, you know, while discovery and awareness are still super important, so is it that the brands leverage social and other digital activities to keep customers engaged with the brand after they make a purchase, because that's just a way to build long-term brand affinity that wasn't really possible 15 years ago in the way it is now. You know, can try really hard to get someone who's purchased a product to keep coming back to your website through things like email marketing and whatever. But social media is just such a powerful touch point that I think that's really the takeaway from this article, that, you know, post-purchase engagement, there's just more opportunity for it now.
Mm-hmm. Very nice, folks. Still all tied up, 7 apiece, heading into round 4. Double points round 4, of course. We start with Karina. We're talking about why Airbnb doesn't have a loyalty program like everyone else. which was a piece written by Alison Pohl of the Journal. She points out that travel loyalty programs are popular with consumers who enjoy flight upgrades and booking hotels with points. But up until now, Airbnb has held out for one reason or another. However, a new rewards program from the Expedia Group, which owns vacation rental site Vrbo and hotels.com, could put pressure on Airbnb. But Karina, Airbnb not having a loyalty program, what's the point?
So for me, this is really about the fact that Airbnb thinks that it's too successful to bother with a loyalty program. And in some ways, I think it's kind of right. It doesn't have a loyalty program, whereas some of its rivals do, but it recorded its best fourth quarter ever in 2022. And it continues to grow and dominate the competition. And I think that's just because it's really focused on its unique brand proposition and a great customer experience. And it really proves that loyalty programs are an element of loyalty, but they're not everything to loyalty. It's not all about offering discounts to loyal members. It's also about offering just a really, really good product that people can't get exactly the same elsewhere. And I think that Airbnb is doing that.
Blake?
Yeah, I don't know if I agree that Airbnb has like a fantastic customer experience strictly because of the fact that, you know, within the home sharing model, a lot of the experience is up to the relationship between the host and the person, you know, renting or staying at the location. And in that sense, I think that rewards points are actually a great way to improve the quality of the home sharing model because, you know, guests could get additional rewards points for higher ratings, which would incentivize good behavior, while hosts could have their own rewards network that might be, look a little bit different, but and reward points for higher ratings, which would incentivize them to provide a better quality of stay. And if those things sort of come and meet together through some sort of program, then that actually could rise the tide and make the quality of Airbnb experiences across the board a lot better than it is now.
Susie.
So my take is a little bit hybrid in that I do agree that Airbnb thought, you know, it was a little bit naive in that they thought they were the first mover. They didn't really identify their competition in the right way. It's not just like home sharing, but it's also RV rentals and it's camping and it's hotels. So I think their view was very narrow and they were very successful. But it's not enough anymore. Budgets are tightening. The experiences are not always consistent. I hadn't thought about the like double reward system, but I was thinking like, can you reward consumers for their loyalty without it being points? Like flowers in the room or, you know, a bottle of champagne or some other sort of like special pillows that you love, something that helps you feel as a consumer known, recognized, loved, and rewarded, that is easy to do, that is still within their business model of the Airbnb. Because like Blake said, it's all about the hosts, right? I do think that as times are changing, competition is increasing for share of wallet, that Airbnb is going to need to do something to stand out from all these other competitors.
Yeah. Very nice, folks. Heck of a game played. This might be some of the highest scores we've had ever, if not in a while.
Karina, this is just for you.
Yeah. So we count the scores. And at the end of the game, a drum roll. The Victoria puts into the show. Thank you for that. Blake is this week's winner of the game of the week. 13 for Blake, Susie and Karina with 11 apiece in a joint second. And just for the listeners, before we hit record, Karina said she won't come back on unless she won. So this is goodbye from Karina. This is the last you'll hear from her.
It was nice to be on.
No, write
in. You can see Karina on other shows such as Around the World and Reimagining Retail.
Or write in and protest so that she comes back.
You have to do that. We don't read any of the messages. Okay, so I'm kidding. We read them all. We get one a year. So, Blake, you win. Congratulations. Very close to the end, though. Some great suggestions. Blake, your point about Airbnb and the rewards. If you, you know, the more stars you get, maybe the more points you get. And then, Susie, I like your idea about unique ways to enhance the experience, whether that is, you know, flowers in the room or some kind of additional experiential perk. It'd be quite cool. Blake, you get the championship belt. And, of course, the last word.
Well, I will say that I did pander a little bit to Marcus in that last response because I know that he travels frequently and likely uses Airbnb.
Maybe.
And he values human decency. So
exactly.
Good and good behavior.
When you said pandering, I thought you were going to talk about a conversation last week when you were finally admitting that the English do some good foods, one of which is the sausage roll.
I never said that.
Don't know what you're talking about, Blake.
I never said such a thing. No, you didn't. That wasn't in the conversation that you're alluding to, in which I may have made some remarks that's not totally accurate. That was a non-recorded private meeting that we had that I thought I didn't know was on record. All right.
What is a sausage roll, anyways?
So good.
A sausage roll is
like a pig in a blanket.
Yeah, it's basically like a pig in a blanket that you have with brown sauce.
Let's move on. It's time now for dinner party data. This is the part of the show where we tell you about the most interesting thing we've learned this week. Blake, one, he goes first.
So this is some data from Instacart that, in honor of July being National Ice Cream Month, they released some data on the top-selling ice cream flavors from each U.S. state. Now, vanilla was hands down the most purchased ice cream flavor in every state, so it's actually a list starting at number two. And actually pretty surprising that Moose Tracks is the top ice cream flavor in 12 states. You know, that was the highest number two. I don't even really know what is in Moose Tracks. I think it's like chocolate with like, it also has like marshmallow and nuts in it, but it's weird. And then the four-way tie for third place was between Rocky Road. I mean, that's mediocre. Green tea, hard pass on green tea. Coffee, yes, but you have to be in the mood for it. And birthday cake, yeah, sure. I just thought it was weird. And then I obviously looked up, you know, my home state of New York and found that pistachio was the most popular. Yeah. A lot of different, a lot of variety here. Can't say it's a very appetizing
proud
list.
Of New York? No.
I'm shocked the chocolate strawberry, like those ones aren't on it.
Moose Track?
Nobody even knows what that
moose,
is.
Moose very Tracks.
Chocolate chip.
Horrible.
I mean, there's so many other more. And like,
what are our favorites here? Susie, favorite?
Chocolate chip. Also peanut butter and chocolate.
Oh, yeah. It was nearly good. Karina.
Mine, mint choc chip or pistachio?
Mint choc chip, yes,
I'm with
pistachio.
New York.
Hazelnut is really good too.
No. Like,
there's a ice cream place in New York that makes its own ice cream, and they have an olive oil based ice cream that they usually mix in with like fruit flavors, so like blueberry or like blood orange. Best ice cream you could ever have.
What is it called?
Very nice.
Or tell me later.
I'll say it on the podcast because it's gotten very popular over the last couple of years. It's called Cafe Panna.
It's
on
Wait,
Irving.
I totally
and
know it.
And if anybody from Cafe Panna is listening to this free promotion that I'm giving, I'm open
Blake
to
awesome.
Yeah, I'm open to free ice cream. I'll keep talking about it.
We just went there like 2 weeks ago. The lines are ridiculous.
Well, like going to the movies, you need to order online ahead of time.
Thank you,
Blake.
Online
That's how
ordering?
Normal people do.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. The answer we were looking for was vanilla. Vanilla, folks. So unfortunately, no one wins that round. We move now to Susie.
So this week is a very famous, globally famous person's 80th birthday. Can you guys guess who?
Mick Jagger.
Yes, I was shocked. He was born in 1943, obviously the lead singer of the Rolling Stones, I think, and Googled, they're best known for the song Satisfaction that was released 1965 when he was 22. So can you guys guess what was one of the world-changing events, according to like a fun fact website that I found? Nachos were invented in Mexico in 1943. Did you
wait? How did we get from
Mick Jagger to Nick?
Yeah,
because I was doing
that was when he was born.
Yeah, the year born. You guys, come on.
Oh, okay. Also in the year he was born.
How did you
follow? Lost me as well, Corey. I don't know what she was talking about.
My first ever live gig was the Rolling Stones at Wembley Stadium.
Oh wow!
Nice.
Ruined
well
me
played.
For live music for the rest of my life.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
He was probably can't get any better than that.
No, he was probably 70 then.
Yeah. No, I'm not that young.
Yeah. Did
I
you
didn't see my first gig at 30?
Sorry, Susie, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I just have two more. Did you know that due to the war, there was a shortage of American football players? So the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Philadelphia Eagles merged into a team called the Steagles.
The Steagles, yeah.
That's cool.
And the most famous American that year was Betty Grable, who had 42 films, grossed over $100 million, was the best paid, highest paid actress and actor, star, it said star, in Hollywood. And in 1943, she had two movies, whereas now our stars take like 5 years to make a movie. She had two movies in 1943.
Very nice. Very nice indeed. Karina, you're up.
I've got some global facts.
Yes.
For you. So the first one is that the Eiffel Tower can be 15 centimetres taller in the summer than it is in the winter due to thermal expansion, which heats up the iron and the particles gain kinetic energy and take up more space.
Hmm. Who's measuring that? Someone at the very top has gone.
There's someone that sits there. Yeah. That's 15 centimetres above what it was in November.
And someone says, Gary, get down from there. No one cares.
Still no one cares. My second one, which is my favourite one, is that Australia is wider than the moon. So apparently the moon is 3,400 kilometres in diameter, and Australia from east to west is almost 4,000. And I love this because from a really geeky e-commerce point of view, that must be an absolute nightmare for fulfillment. And it perhaps explains why Amazon Prime members in Australia only get two-day delivery, not next day, unless they live in certain postcodes in Sydney and Melbourne.
Yeah, Trevor, who's delivered in Australia, anytime he gets pulled up by his manager on not getting things to people fast enough, he's like, it's bigger than the moon.
Bigger than the moon.
I'm doing my best.
You know what I took away from
that? That's a good excuse.
That the moon is gigantic. I had no idea how big the moon was. No.
Susie's like looking out into the...
Probably.
It looks like it's so tiny. It looks like a penny size. Wait,
oh,
and the moon is not
goodness.
Even the biggest star.
It's not.
It's not a
it's
star.
It's not, no, yeah. There, it's a.
It's not a planet. Then what is it?
It's a moon.
Stop.
It's not like it's not the moon. Like it's a moon. We just refer to it as the moon because it's Earth's moon, but like other planets have moons.
It's the moon.
Victoria, take this moon. Out. I cannot have my nieces hear this.
I hope they're not coming to you for homework advice. My
no,
goodness.
They're probably Googling it. They're asking Google.
As they should.
No, they're not. They're absolutely not. They believe in the honor code of their school and are doing their homework by themselves.
Well played. All right, I've got one for you real quick. It's about museums around the world. So three facts. One, the Art Newspapers Visitor Figures 2022 reported that 141 million visits were paid to the top 100 museums in that year, in 2022. That's twice as many as 2021, three times as many as 2020, but it's just over 60% of pre-pandemic 2019 levels, when 230 million people were reported to have visited the top 100 museums in the world. Point two, before the pandemic in 2019, the top five most visited museums in the world were, can you guys guess one?
Yes, the Louvre.
Yes.
The Louvre, the Met, and the, I think it's the National Gallery in China.
And the one in London.
The Natural History Museum.
Wow, you guys nearly got all of them. So I'll go in reverse order. Number five, the British Museum. Yeah. Number four, the Met in New York. Number three, the Vatican Museums. Number two is the National Museum of China. And number one is the Louvre in Paris. That was then. As of 2022, though, because of travel restrictions and people still not traveling as much as they used to, as of 2022, the Louvre still at number one. Vatican Museums jumped into second place. London's Natural History Museum is now moved onto the leaderboard at three. The British Museum in London is up one place to fourth. And rounding out the new top five is Washington, D.C.'s National Museum of Natural History. The third fact is that the Louvre, or the Louvre Museum, the National Art Museum of Paris in France, is the world's most visited museum. In 2019, the Parisian landmark was pulling in nearly 10 million visitors a year. That's 3,000 visitors each of the 6 days of a week they're open. That would be 4,000 visitors per hour, 61 per minute. Or put another way, one person visits the Louvre every second they are open.
Does it expand in the summer, though?
Gary?
Otherwise, I'm not interested.
We've made a lot of jokes about buying your tickets ahead of time on this podcast, but please, for the love of God, if you're going to the Louvre, buy your tickets ahead of time. Yes. You cannot just walk into that place.
Although the one time I've been, I did just walk in. I think maybe it was like a free, free weekend day. I don't know what was going on. Maybe I wasn't supposed to be there. It was a private event. I definitely just walked in. But yes, everyone else, you will need to buy them ahead of time. Visits at the museum are back to 80% of pre-pandemic levels. So they are getting there. That's what we've got time for this episode. Thank you so, so much to my guests. Thank you to Karina.
Thanks, Marcus. I might come back.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice. She's not happy. Thank you to Susie.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, thank you to this week's winner of the Game of the Week, Blake.
Thanks, Marcus.
And thank you, of course, to Victoria, who edits the show. James, who copy edits it. Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone for listening in. You can head to behindthenumbers_podcast on Instagram to say hi to us if you'd like. I won't, but Bill Fisher will hopefully see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Around the World show, an eMarks podcast made possible by Verisk Marketing Solutions. Happy weekends.
I do have a friend that moved to Australia and said it's quicker to order from the UK.
So move to the moon.
Move to the moon. Okay. And said it's quicker to order from the UK than it is to order from some Australian.
First of all, can we please say move to a moon and not to the moon so we don't confuse people?
Amazing.